ice walls and ice falls at around 8,000 meters. The Chinese climber recalled humbly embracing being part of Mother Nature after he completed his arduous journey.
不管你是残疾人也好，你是正常。
No matter if you're disabled or normal, whether you have lost your eyesight or you have no legs or hands, it doesn't matter. As long as you have a strong mind, you can always complete anything that other people think you can't.
你都可以去完成一件别人认为不可。
Zhang added that this is only the beginning. He said his next milestone is climbing the highest peaks from the world's continents, known as the Seven Summits. The Chinese mountaineer lost his eyesight at the age of 21. After his success, he became the third visually impaired person to ever step foot on the Everest peak. Russian company has developed a fully self-driving car that looks like it was taken right out of a sci-fi movie. Flip is the size of a conventional passenger car and has enough space for six people. Its creator says the advanced vehicle is a taxi of the future. Flip has fulfilled the requirements of international automated driving standards. It's powered by electricity, but it can also use other fuels like gas and hydrogen. The owners of this futuristic vehicle do not have to worry about running out of power. That's because its replaceable batteries can be changed in less than 5 minutes once they are out of electricity. A rare baby giraffe is born in a zoo in western France. As conservationists try to increase the population of this endangered species. The cute Rothschild giraffe is the second born in a French zoo this year. Caretakers say the cubs will stay with a facility for 1 year before they would be sent to another site to start their own families. The Rothschild giraffes are critically endangered, and conservationists say that only 1,600 of them exist now. The general giraffe populations in the wild have also decreased by around 30% in the last 3 decades.
For many professional climbers, ascending Mount Everest for even once remains an almost distant dream. However, a Nepali man has achieved that feat not once or twice, but 25 times. Kami Rita Sherpa has arrived back in the capital, Kathmandu, after breaking his own whopping record of 24 ascents to the summit of the world's tallest mountain. The veteran climber hopes that his accomplishment represents a big achievement for his small country. Climbing tall mountains runs in Kami's blood. He belongs to the Sherpa tribe, one of the Tibetan ethnic groups and native to the most mountainous region of Nepal.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The limelight.
Like the blockade of Gaza, that it resembles the blockade of Yemen, slowly strangles civilians to death without doing anything to hold the flow of weapons, says Daniel Larison, journalist, in an article titled "Lift Criminal Blockade on Yemen." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Biden administration hasn't followed through on its commitment to end U.S. support for the Saudi coalition war on Yemen. Almost 4 months since Biden announced the end to U.S. support for Saudi coalition offensive operations, the administration refuses to tell Congress what kind of support it has halted and what it has continued. A request from 41 members of Congress to clarify the extent of ongoing U.S. support for the Saudi coalition went unanswered for months. And then, recently, the State Department delivered a non-answer that failed to provide any new information. Meanwhile, the coalition blockade that has delayed and diverted ships and prevented the delivery of essential goods remains in place with deadly consequences for the civilian population. And the U.S. has approved additional arms sales to Saudi Arabia regime and the United Arab Emirates earlier this year. Biden appears to have used his February announcement to check off a box to placate anti-war progressives, and since then he seems to have forgotten about the issue entirely. Congress needs to reassert itself once again and pass a resolution requiring an end to all U.S. assistance to the Saudi coalition war effort. And opponents of the war need to press the Biden administration to insist on an end to the killing blockade. Yemen's humanitarian crisis continues to worsen the longer that the war drags on, and Biden has burned for months without making any real progress in alleviating the crisis or establishing a ceasefire. When Biden made the initial announcement about cutting off support for offensive operations, opponents of the war were cautiously hopeful that this was just the first step and curtailing U.S. assistance to the governments that had been starving and wrecking Yemen for the last 6 years. The caveat that Biden was ending support for offensive operations was worrisome because the Saudi coalition has dishonestly described their entire war effort as one of self-defense, and this loophole may have allowed more U.S. support for the Saudi coalition to continue uninterrupted. The administration's opacity makes it difficult to know what, if anything, has changed since Trump left office. State Department's letter told members of Congress nothing that they could not have learned in a newspaper. It rehearsed the Biden administration's previous announcements and mostly focused on what the Yemen Special Envoy Tim Lender King has been doing for the last 2 months. Like Lender King himself, who famously said that he was not totally in that information loop on current U.S. military assistance to the Saudi coalition, the State Department had nothing to say about the nature or extent of U.S. support except to say that the United States will continue to support Saudi Arabia with its defense against inbound threats. It is telling that the White House asked the State Department to respond to the letter when it seems clear that no one at the state knows anything about what the Pentagon is or isn't doing to support the Saudi coalition. The president fobbed off the request to the people that didn't have the desired information, and then they dragged their feet in sending back a pro forma response that leaves Congress in the dark. The administration is not as boastful and enthusiastic about U.S. support for the Saudi coalition as Trump was, but it appears to be unwilling to take the necessary steps to cut off U.S. backing for their war in its entirety. The Saudi coalition continues to commit crimes against humanity by keeping this blockade in place. Like the blockade of Gaza that it resembles, the blockade of Yemen slowly strangles civilians to death without doing anything to hold the flow of weapons. Lifting the blockade must be separated from a ceasefire. Keeping it in place does nothing to end the fighting, but we know that it is killing the weakest and most vulnerable Yemenis every day. Senators recently wrote to the U.S. president and called on him to press for an end to the killing blockade, which is unquestionably part of the Saudi coalition's attack on Yemen. The senators reminded Biden of the severe effects that the blockade is having on the population. The UN estimates that 16 million Yemenis will face hunger this year, and 400,000 children younger than 5 years old are at risk of dying of starvation if the conflict continues and this war tactic persists. Lifting the blockade will not end the war, and it is not a panacea for Yemen's humanitarian crisis, but it will make it easier to bring in essential goods and fuel so that more Yemenis can get the food and medicine they need. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the U.S. state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars right here in canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's gonna be any change, it starts with our children.
This is gonna be my fighter right here. Come here.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Richard was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Leek, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism, and that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm-hmm. But as we know, the African American community have been plagued by police brutality mm-hmm. for decades. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and colour pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964, yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the street just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the street with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted, yes, as saying, the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy, in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized, and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's It's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, you wanted to quickly add
something? I think what it also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale of racism and what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, Muslim, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on and is fighting.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
we
racial
did see
inequality.
A lot of white people in the crowd in support of the black community.
No, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there. We'll continue this, just taking a break now.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch sticker on there. Got some walkie-talkies. It's two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one of my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff, and that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera. That's my weapon, you know. And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
So David there with the Cop Watch Initiative is quite an endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And, of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile?
Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
And Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that monitorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time. And the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long
a break now from the discussion.
Good evening. My name is Bernie Frazier, and like all of you all, I'm a Ferguson resident.
percent who have become very fearful of living in this community. But I would like to help you understand one thing. There are many people who have only been fearful for 2 months. There are more people who have been fearful for 2 decades.
Must have been very awkward for the black police officer to be in that situation, probably felt feeling very conflicted. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire, and by the Washington Post it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017 and is on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think it's largely because of the failure of US justice system to deliver equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. You've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017. Those are the numbers you expect in a small war, somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. Mm-hmm. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you were saying, it's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal, yep, 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of oppressive policing and marginalization, and it's that system that's carried on.
People are
just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man-in-chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world, and it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we must put out. That's how dangerous this man is.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camila Shambiati.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The limelight.
Hybrid COVID-19 strain fuels new outbreak that threatens Samsung, Apple, LG, Panasonic, Foxconn, and other high-tech giant production facilities in Vietnam. Here we present you an article in this regard written by David Hart under the heading, New Vietnam Variant Imperils Global Supply Chains. The article was published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay tuned. Vietnam's Health Minister Nguyen Thanh Long said recently that authorities had detected a new variant of COVID-19, a hybrid of the strains first found in India and Britain, and which could be more contagious than other known variants. Genetic sequencing by Vietnam's National Institute of Hygiene and Epidemiology has reportedly detected 4 people infected with the new variant. The minister said the new strain may explain why infections are spiking so quickly in Vietnam. At the time of reporting, infections have been recorded in at least half of Vietnam's 63 municipalities and provinces. That's ringing alarm bells, not just locally but worldwide, inside of Vietnam's growing role in industrial supply chains. Vietnam recorded only 1,465 cases in all of 2020 and was one of few countries worldwide to record positive economic growth of 2.9%. But a spike since early April has seen case numbers rise above 7,100. Some 325 new infections were recorded on May 31st, above the 7-day average of 290. So far, 47 deaths have been confirmed. However, according to Nguyen Phuc Duong, a PhD candidate at Victoria University of Wellington, the new Vietnamese government that took the reins earlier this year is less willing to impose tough restrictions than the previous administration. According to the Oxford COVID-19 Government Response Tracker and its stringency index, in which 0 represents no restrictions and 100 is the strictest, Vietnam was home to some of the most stringent restrictions in Southeast Asia in 2020. However, at the latest data studied, May 24th, Vietnam's stringency rating was lower than Malaysia and Laos. Moreover, current restrictions are indexed as less stringent than they were in early February and in the summer of 2020 during a second wave of the pandemic in Vietnam. Duong said economic concerns are the obvious reason, not least because the economy has been weak after a year of COVID, and the pressure to keep industrial zones open amidst worries about production disruptions. While Vietnam is forecast to grow by 6.6% in 2021, the World Bank says the government has been fixated in recent weeks on keeping supply chains running. The health ministry has raised concerns that infection rates are growing rapidly in the industrial zones in northern Bac Ninh and Bac Duong provinces near the capital Hanoi, where major foreign brands including Samsung and Foxconn have factories. On Saturday, June 5th, the ministry announced it would prioritize vaccinations for 240,000 workers in the area, sending at least 200,000 vaccines to each of the two provinces in the hope that they can all be administered within a week. According to an official statement released recently, the Vietnamese government also appealed to the likes of Samsung and Apple to help procure vaccines for their own workforce. Vietnamese factories produce an estimated half of Samsung's global phone and tablet output, making Vietnam the second largest exporter of smartphones in the world after China. After a $670 million US dollars investment in a mobile phone manufacturing plant in Bac Ninh province in 2008, Samsung's countrywide investments rose to $17.3 billion within a decade. Intel has also invested at least $1 billion in a semiconductor assembly and testing facility in Ho Chi Minh City. Tech giants LG, Apple, Panasonic, and Foxconn are also heavily invested in Vietnam. Global electronics industry now accounts for about 40% of Vietnam's exports. By 2019, the country had become the fourth largest exporter of electrical goods and components to the U.S. According to the Ministry of Industry and Trade, Vietnam's combined exported goods were worth $281.5 billion last year, up 6.5% from 2019. Vietnam has been one of the chief beneficiaries of international decoupling from China as Western, Japanese, and Korean firms have sought to move their operations away from single market production in recent years, a trend accelerated by the U.S.-China trade war that began in 2018. Any major disruption to these new supply chains will put Vietnam in a spotlight and under on a constant pressure, especially as industrial production in China has seemingly returned to pre-pandemic normalcy. Bac Ninh province, home to most of Samsung's factories in Vietnam, recently imposed curfews and other service restrictions, while four industrial parks across the two provinces were temporarily closed. It is believed they will soon reopen as factories have been advised by the government to offer alternative arrangements for workers. Reports indicate that factories within special economic zones in these provinces, as well as other industrial heartlands, are converting more warehouses into living quarters for workers to limit the impact on production. Provincial authorities have suggested companies take such measures, as well as rotating staff in shift work to limit contact between employees. Comments by the Korea Chamber of Business in Vietnam to the press in recent weeks suggest that the surge in infections has most strongly hit small and medium-sized factories in Vietnam, whereas the large production centers run by multinational firms have been better able to maintain production. Jiang said the government is biding its time for the vaccinations, and given the possibility of domestic vaccine production from September onward, it is less likely to impose lockdown measure in critical industrial provinces such as Bắc Ninh, Bắc Giang, and Thái Nguyên. He added, Chin's provincial government is surely taking a huge risk, but whether it has paid off or not, we need to wait and see in a few months. On the whole, Vietnam has been the standout performer in Southeast Asia. The country of 96 million people has recorded just over 7,000 cases since the pandemic began. Neighboring Cambodia of 16 million people has had more than 30,000 cases. However, it is falling behind in terms of vaccination. According to official data, around 1.4 million people in Vietnam, or 1% of the population, have had one dose, but only 28,529 have received all their necessary doses. According to our rolled-in data, vaccination rates peaked in late April and early May, when around 6/10 per 100 people were being vaccinated, but it has since fallen to around 1/10 in recent weeks. Vietnam has signed a deal with some medicine companies for 30 million doses to be delivered later this year, and is currently in talks with some other companies that, if successful, would provide enough doses to fully vaccinate 80% of the population. The government has also said Vietnamese firms will be able to bring their own vaccine to market by September or October. Recently, the authorities announced that they intend to test all 9 million residents of Ho Chi Minh City, the country's largest city and Vietnam's business hub. Local news reports suggest that the testing capacity will be 100,000 people per day, a rate that would take months if the entire city is to undergo a test.
Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations. The UN says 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from famine. Yemen has struggled with mass outbreaks of infectious diseases, and poverty has surged to affect as much as 78% of the population since 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional states launched a devastating war on Yemen. The U.S. and several other Western countries have participated in the war by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi coalition. The United Nations says the Saudi-led war on Yemen has caused an estimated 233,000 deaths, including 131,000 from an indirect cause such as lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. Meanwhile, The World Food Program has estimated that around 400,000 Yemeni children under 5 are likely to die of starvation in 2021. That is nearly one child every 80 seconds. While the results of the US-sponsored Saudi aggression on Yemen speak for themselves, Washington is trying to push a narrative that the Ansarullah movement is mostly to blame for the ongoing problems in Yemen, not Saudi Arabia. After returning from a trip to some Arab states of the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, the US Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, accused Ansarullah of refusing a proposed ceasefire. However, the movement has consistently participated in peace talks with the Saudis and allies of former Saudi-backed government. The main reason for the failure of previous peace talks was that the Saudis refused any deal involving power sharing or a fresh election. That's why the Saudi-enforced war on Yemen was aimed at bringing the Saudi-backed former regime to power and crush the popular Ansarullah movement. Despite years of ongoing aggression against Yemenis and spending billions of dollars, Saudi Arabia and its supporter, the U.S., have been unable to defeat the popular Ansarullah movement, and the recent willingness to negotiate a truce proves their weakened position.
The U.S. narrative should be ignored because it has nothing to do with reality or truth. The people of Yemen continue to suffer because of U.S. actions, because of U.S. sending weapons to Saudi Arabia. The Ansarullah movement has nothing to do with, they're defending the people of Yemen, certainly, but they are not the reason for the war. It is Saudi aggression financed by the United States that is the reason for the war.
The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen has accused Yemen's Ansarullah movement of not trying to reach an urgently needed ceasefire in the war-torn country. That's why the Biden administration has refused to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen, which is a key Ansarullah condition for a ceasefire. The Saudi-enforced blockade has caused a lack of food and medicine. Meanwhile, the Ansarullah movement, as well as activists and international aid groups, have been calling on Riyadh to separate the blockade from the negotiations and not use the suffering of ordinary Yemenis as a bargaining chip. Moreover, the U.S. administration of Joe Biden has tried to show itself as a so-called impartial mediator, trying to resolve the ongoing conflict in Yemen. For instance, in February, the Biden administration announced that the United States was ending its support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen. But Biden said Washington will continue to help Saudi Arabia defend its sovereignty and land. Washington's so-called defensive support for Riyadh includes providing maintenance services to Saudi Arabia's warplanes that are bombing Yemen.
When Joe Biden became president, he made some statements about no longer financing the war in Yemen, no longer supporting it, but he continues to send arms to Saudi Arabia. Now, he calls these defensive, but that's not what they're used for. As long as the profits continue to flow to the United States, the government doesn't care who's dying, the U.S. government doesn't care whose blood is flowing, whose children are suffering and dying, as long as the profits continue to accrue to the United States. So that's what's happening now. Biden can say that he doesn't support the war anymore, but continues to send armaments that are being used in that war. So it's complete hypocrisy, which is typical for the United States. It's an ongoing, unfortunate tradition with the United States, and it's not going to stop under Joe Biden.
Washington previously announced it is halting its support for offensive Saudi-led operations in Yemen, but the U.S. is still helping Saudis in the Yemen war. Furthermore, Washington has refrained from holding Saudi Arabia accountable for the current crisis in Yemen as it has refused to pressure Riyadh into lifting the blockade on Yemen or to end its aggression. And that is a clear sign of the U.S. shielding of Saudi Arabia and Washington's contribution to this war.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has strongly condemned a United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
The
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said, taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states. He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme conditions imposed by the U.S. on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees. He accused the United States of attempting to mass-starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears.
The UN should totally understand Iran's position. It's been sanctioned by the worst international sanctions ever imposed on a nation, arguably, in the modern era. And yet the United Nations has religiously decided to ignore the realities and the circumstances of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, it goes deeper than this. The United Nations relies on the US of A for its funds. The majority of the funds that keep the United Nations going come from America. And of course, they're based primarily in the US as well. It's a misnomer to imagine that the UN is independent.
In the meantime, Iran maintains that it has always paid its dues to the international body, despite the sanctions. The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says the country has regularly paid its UN membership contributions during the past years, despite unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran, which have made financial transactions difficult for the Islamic Republic. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Tehran has been in talks with the UN Treasury to settle the debt. He also urged the world body to introduce a self-transaction channel after the U.S. blocked the previous channels used by the Islamic Republic to transfer money. The foreign ministry spokesman said Iran has proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the arrears. He said the United Nations Secretariat is completely aware of the details of the issue, which he said was not Iran's fault whatsoever. According to a statement by the UN General Assembly, as of 21st of May 2021, five member states are subject to provisions of Article 19 of the Charter, including Iran and the Central African Republic.
Nothing is being left unturned, no stone is being left unturned to make Iran bow. Islamic Republic of Iran is arguably one of the last nations still not to be part of the Bank of International Settlements, subjugated sovereign powers. There's a running theme. Those who control those institutions and have those levers of power don't want Iran to succeed in any way, because the Islamic Republic of Iran stands for a set of principles, primarily Islamic principles, but humanitarian principles and real principles of justice and fairness.
This is while the same article allows an exception for member states that can demonstrate that conditions beyond their control contributed to their inability to make payments. But the world body has so far rejected Iran's argument that the impact of the sanctions prevented Tehran from paying off its arrears.
Open letter by dozens of European officials. The purpose, to end unwarranted public criticism of inquiries into alleged Israeli war crimes in Palestine. Such is the context of an apparent push by 50 European officials to have the ICC complete its investigation. These officials include former foreign ministers, prime ministers, and senior international officials, including two British Conservative former ministers. Roadblocks were thrown the ICC's way when the inquiry opened. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump sanctioned ICC court officials from pursuing the matter, something the new U.S. administration reversed.
Well, Donald Trump's position was highly criticized by
various governments and many other other people, because it was, you know, just totally out of line. There's no question in my mind that Israel's committed human